I grew up in a small town in Ohio, about 45 minutes outside of Cleveland. And it was a very safe, homogenous kind of community, and not a lot of creativity crept in. And it was very conformist, and I felt a little bit constrained. So I got into skateboarding and punk rock music and all those kinds of things, and started to look a little crazy. And I think it sort of cemented in me a love for the underdog to some extent, or for people who sort of march to the beat of their own drummers, at least an understanding of that perspective. And then when I got into college, I got into more like political causes and things like that, and just decided that when I went into law that I wanted to do something that helped people who were under-resourced and marginalized to some extent. And so my first job out of law school was advocating for people with mental health issues in Nevada. And I did mostly I represented folks in civil commitment hearings and forcible administration of medication hearings. It was really good, valuable work, and I loved it. But I didn't like living in Las Vegas so much. So I ended up moving to San Diego, and that's where I got a job in the senior legal program, representing people 60 and over in San Diego County with all sorts of issues. But I was really drawn to nursing homes. I did a fair number of home visits in nursing homes and long-term care communities, probably at least once a month. And I was pretty disturbed by what I was seeing on a number of levels. So I just decided to try to do more work in that area. And my boss and I wrote some grants, and we got some funding to do a resident rights project where I focus solely on suing nursing homes for violating resident rights using a statute that we have in California to do that. I'm just really super interested in the civil rights issues that are presented in long-term care facilities. I'm really interested in the perverse incentives that exist in the long-term care system, and all the different potential for policy reform.
That's very cool. It's an interesting background. How and when did COVID kind of first get on your radar, and how did you know that it was going to so heavily impact your work?
So I'm just thinking about this. I thought there were of a couple words when I so I'm thinking back to maybe February, when you're just reading it, sort of on the back pages of the newspapers, that there's the virus in China, and it's getting into other countries, and people are getting sick, and it predominantly was impacting older people more than anybody else. I think my initial response was dismissive, that I didn't worry about it much at all. I also think that I was perturbed by it, that I thought it was taking me away from the work that I had been focused on for the last several years, and now I'm going to have to deal with this, and I don't really want to deal with it. I want to keep working on the other things that I've dedicated my time to. So initially my response was very underwhelming. I just thought, this will last a few weeks at most. This is even when Life Care Centers was happening in Kirkland. But what really got my attention was the visitation ban initially. I was like, okay, now this can't be ignored. Even before the visitation ban went into effect, there were a lot of visitation barriers being thrown up by different facilities, and people were calling us, they're saying I can't visit my loved one unless I watch a video about hand washing. Is this legal? So I had to deal with the visitation issue a lot. And then it seemed to, obviously, it got really serious in late March and April as the infection rates went up, and New Jersey and New York seemed to be exploding with COVID. But from a policy perspective in California, the two big events were we had the Department of Public Health initially telling nursing homes, like they did in New York, that they had to accept COVID positive patients from hospitals, that they couldn't deny them admission, which got our attention, and we tried to push back against. And eventually the state did issue some guidance that was a lot more ambiguous, but still kind of sounded like a mandate in ways. And then the other big issue was immunity. There was a quest in California, like there was in so many other states, from the nursing home industry to get immunity from any civil liability related to COVID or even outside of COVID. And that took a lot of our attention, at least in the early months, April and May of 2020, I'm thinking.
So looking back on the whole situation, would you have done anything differently in terms of, you know, your work?
That's a good question. I think just retrospectively, I wish I had been a little more aware of what the infection control regulations required prior to COVID-19. Infection control was, I don't recall ever having a significant case involving infection control. I don't ever recall looking at infection control deficiencies with any regularity, thinking about infection control systemically. I mean, my only experience with infection control was mostly bad, but it still didn't trigger anything with me. I used to give the media a lot of examples of where in the past I would go into nursing homes to see residents, and there would be particular infection control protocols for this resident. There would be, you know, yellow tape across the door, and there would be gowns and masks and booties to wear when you went into their rooms. And I would put all that stuff on before I went into their room. And then I would see nurses come in and drop a food tray without following any of those protocols. So I would see violations all the time, but it, unfortunately, it wasn't a priority for me ever until about March of 2020. So I think going from March forward, I think we did the best we could. It was an overwhelming time. I have three young kids who were all out of school. So I was dealing with that at home, and it seemed like just the world was falling apart. So, there's nothing that I wish I would have done differently from that point on, but just before the pandemic, if I had spent a little more time on infection control, I mean, there are studies that show that hundreds of thousands of long-term care residents across the country die every year of preventable infections. And that just had never really sunk in with me as it should have.
Yeah, definitely. I understand that. And so last question, looking forward, what are some of the biggest changes that you hope to come out of this in long-term care?
So what's interesting about thinking forward is it's really unaffected by COVID-19. COVID-19 exposed or amplified problems that already existed in the system. And the things I would recommend going forward for long-term care are the same things I would have recommended 2 years ago prior to any of this happening. And it would be, as it relates to understaffing, addressing understaffing, that's the primary factor in quality of care in facilities, generally speaking. And the understaffed facilities tended to do more poorly on COVID-19 outbreaks than those that were better staffed. Paying the staff more money and giving them better benefits became an issue when at least in the initial stages where we had staff who were working multiple jobs in multiple facilities, getting COVID-19 in one facility and bringing it into the other. I think that was probably the greatest source of infection, at least in the early months of COVID-19. So the issue of better pay, better working conditions, better training for the staff was a big deal. The institutional nature of long-term care, unfortunately, especially in nursing homes, I think was a big problem before COVID-19, and certainly became a big problem during COVID-19 when there just wasn't enough space to keep people isolated from one another, to keep them from spreading infection to one another. Just that the idea of housing a bunch of people in a very small space and rooming them together where they have virtually no privacy I don't think anybody thinks that's a good idea, but that's sort of the way the system was set up, and it's what we've enabled through funding over the last several decades. I think hopefully the pandemic will certainly seem to get a lot of attention of the media and the public in terms of what alternatives there might be. So hopefully funding starts to steer into that direction. That's about it. So, I mean, the same resident rights issues are always a big deal for us. And we still have lots of visitation restrictions that we're trying to deal with. There's still lots of rights waivers that went into effect now almost a year and a half ago that are still out there that are causing problems for residents. So I think dealing with resident rights, mostly through enforcement. Enforcement, of course, is one of our big issues. Enforcement was, I said a few days ago that it was abysmal before the pandemic and it was non-existent during the pandemic, or virtually non-existent. So as we tell lots of people, the standards of care are pretty good in the regulations. The problem has always been enforcement. If there's no enforcement, then the regulations don't really mean much. And there was no greater example of that than the infection control violations that we were experiencing in the first half of 2020.
Yeah, it sounds like pretty much everything you said is things that since I've started in this field are things that people have been pushing for years, much, you know, a long time before the pandemic. So
Yeah. I mean, what we found and what the studies are showing now is that the facilities with good track records that, you know, do provide patient-centered care are inclusive of families and friends as part of the recovery process, they did better than the facilities with bad track records that are insular and exclusive and understaffed. It makes sense.
Well, thank you so much again for participating in this project.